Just
no, I can do it. Just left click. Is that right? Hello, everyone. Thanks for hanging with us. It's a beautiful day out there, and I'm sure you'd rather be getting ready for a nice lunch on the water, but we appreciate you coming here instead. The title of my talk is Improving Early Access to Prenatal Care, Medicaid Outreach and Enrollment Strategies for Pregnant Women. It's a topic that's very near and dear to my heart because about 20 years ago when I was a young public health or public administration professional, this was an issue that I really dove into and sort of cut my teeth on as a professional. In the late 1980s, it was a pretty exciting time for Medicaid programs. They broke free of the shackles of the AFDC program, started doing some very innovative things in terms of raising income eligibility for pregnant women. There was a huge coalition of forces moving together to try to improve pregnancy outcomes and birth outcomes with Medicaid as a primary financer. And I was working at the time at the National Governors Association and had access to all 50 states' Medicaid programs and made contacts there and did some neat work way back then in the day. Anyway, it's great to be working on these issues again, and the March of Dimes gets the credit for supporting the research that we've done, given their obvious focus on improving birth outcomes. So I want to thank March of Dimes, acknowledge them, as well as Colleen Sanosky, our project officer. Before I go any further, also I want to acknowledge my co-author and some of my colleagues on this work, the National Academy for State Health Policy. I don't know if any of you know that group, but they're a terrific organization in Washington, D.C., a nonprofit that works pretty much to represent state officials who work in the healthcare area. Lots of work with Medicaid directors, lots of work with maternal and child health programs as well. So Shelley Geshen was my principal partner on this work. Okay. My talk is really divided into about four or five parts. I'm going to give you a little bit of an overview of the project goal and background on the study. I'm then going to go back in time again, the 20 years I spoke of a moment ago, to when perinatal outreach and enrollment was really a major dominant force in Medicaid. Talk a little bit about that history and how it sets a context for our work here. I'm then going to present findings of two sorts. I'm going to talk about a survey of 50 state Medicaid programs and then some follow-up case studies that we did. And I'll finish with some overarching conclusions and policy implications. So this project was launched about a year and a half ago, again with funding from the March of Dimes. The goal of the project was to establish or determine what the state of the art is, so to speak, of Medicaid outreach and enrollment initiatives targeting pregnant women. The notion was that we would survey all 50 states and develop that state-of-the-art baseline, but also identify best practices, what were the innovations going on out there in the states, primarily so that we could pass that information on to the March of Dimes chapters out in all the states so that they could understand what innovations were going on in their partner states and also hopefully influence policy development in the states in which they worked. The Urban Institute teamed up with NASHPE, the National Academy for State Health Policy, partly because of a shared expertise and interest in the issues, but also because of NASHPE's access to the Medicaid directors, very, very good access to those groups. The scope of work of our contract with the March of Dimes was quite broad. We were to develop a literature review of maternal and infant health indicators and state activities to address access to prenatal care, 50-state email survey, which was primarily headed up by NASHPE, some follow-up telephone interviews with 10 states that emerged from the survey as doing particularly innovative things, and then some in-depth case studies with three states to really learn the ins and outs of what some good states were doing. So why this focus, and why now? The March of Dimes was really interested in revisiting this issue for a number of reasons. Over the past 20 years, there have been pretty complex and divergent trends going on with maternal and infant health indicators. On the one hand, some rates have been improving, infant mortality and early entry into prenatal care. On the other hand, rates of preterm birth, low birth weight, very low birth weight have really increased and gotten worse, and racial disparities have been very persistent. At the same time, there's been a very much of a fluctuating policy stance on access to prenatal care when it comes to public programs like Medicaid. Whereas they were the dominant focus of policy attention and innovation in the late 80s, early 90s, they've kind of been eclipsed by kids. The big focus in the last 10-plus years has been on the state children's health insurance program and trying to expand coverage for children. And a third set of reasons is that there have been major changes in healthcare delivery and financing in the period since pregnant women were a big focus under Medicaid. Managed care, Medicaid managed care has been rolled out in all 50 states and has become a dominant force. And there are obviously big implications for how prenatal care is delivered in a managed care setting. So there hasn't been a really careful look at this issue for since about the time when I was doing it back in the early 90s, and so that's why we've decided to launch into this study. Just a little bit of history. I'll throw a few acronyms your way that may or may not sound familiar. There were a series of omnibus budget reconciliation acts in the late 1980s, 86, over 87, over 89, that all did pretty wonderful things in terms of expanding access to financial access, at least, to prenatal care and delivery services. OBRA 86 was kind of the first major law that allowed states to raise their income eligibility for Medicaid for pregnant women up to the poverty level, and took a big step by delinking health coverage from cash assistance coverage. OBRA 87 followed the next year and gave states the option to raise income eligibility even higher to 185% of poverty. OBRA 89 followed and actually set up a federal minimum coverage of 133% of poverty for pregnant women. As important as those provisions were, there were also a lot of other provisions in the law that I think were just as, if not more important. They provided states with a lot of flexibility to simplify enrollment procedures. Everyone kind of remembers the horror stories about what it was like to apply for AFDC or cash assistance. Very onerous, very difficult. Lots of barriers put in place specifically with the objective of keeping the rolls down. These laws helped free states to do innovative things with eligibility, gave states the ability to drop the assets test from the eligibility process, provide continuous eligibility throughout pregnancy, regardless of any fluctuations in income that a woman might experience. It allowed states to provide presumptive eligibility, you probably heard of that, which allows a woman to have short-term coverage of her prenatal care while her full eligibility is being determined. The laws also spurred unprecedented investments in outreach, and states really kind of went full steam ahead with both media, statewide sort of strategies, as well as more grassroots and community efforts. And finally, there was a great new collaboration that occurred, again, in the late 80s, between Medicaid agencies and maternal and child health agencies that had kind of unprecedented as well. And one of the outgrowths of that work was that this discussion of the fact that coverage is not enough, that the content of care is also obviously very important. So there was a whole movement to enhance the scope of prenatal coverage in Medicaid. And another acronym, COBRA, the Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act, gave states some flexibility to enrich benefits for pregnant women, and particularly in the area of psychosocial support services. So what happened during those heady times? By the early 1990s, almost half the states had covered pregnant women up to 185% of poverty or higher. Almost all states had dropped assets tests from their eligibility process, adopted continuous eligibility, outstationed social services eligibility workers in clinic settings. About half the states had adopted presumptive eligibility. About half, again, had shortened their forms for pregnant women to make them easier and quicker. A lot had developed significant outreach campaigns. And in fact, the vast majority of states had adopted enhanced prenatal benefits for pregnant women. So things as of about 91, 92 were looking really quite good. And the key research question that we had for this study, since it really hadn't been looked at too closely or systematically since, was to what extent have these efforts been maintained or even expanded upon? So the first set of findings I'm going to share with you are based on the survey. We did the survey by email. It was done a little bit over a year ago, so some of the findings may have changed. The folks at NASHBE, again, administered the survey. Let me first talk a little bit about enrollment strategies. This is a map that shows you where states are in terms of their upper income limit for Medicaid for pregnant women. And the highlights here are that all but 11 states have set upper income limits that are above the federal minimum requirement of 133% of poverty. And in fact, 36 states cover pregnant women at 185% of poverty or higher. This is a higher total than was the case back in 1991 or 1992. We asked a lot of questions about how states, what their policies were in terms of how pregnant women could apply for coverage under Medicaid. And here you see the broad range of ways that women can apply for coverage. 25 states have special shortened application forms for pregnant women that are different from the general population. 45 states have applications available online for downloading. 15 of those 45 actually allow women to submit applications online, which is quite an innovation. And almost every state allows applications to be mailed in. So these are all changes that are fundamentally, again, if you rewind back to the late 80s, everything required a face-to-face interview in a county social services office. And you can see here that, a lot of distance from that. And here again, most of these state totals are higher than they were in the early 90s. So we see movement in the right direction. States continue to use a range of strategies to simplify the enrollment process. 18 states allow women to self-declare what their income is when they apply. In other words, don't have to produce income stubs or any kind of documentation. 44 states continue to keep the assets questions out of the application process. 29 states allow presumptive eligibility. 11 more states have some other process for expediting coverage of pregnant women. The only dim finding, I think, in this page is related to outstationing eligibility workers. There are actually federal rules that require state Medicaid programs to place eligibility workers from a social services system out in federally qualified health centers and hospitals that receive disproportionate share of funding. And despite that federal requirement, only 35 states do so. Most of those states would argue, however, that they put lots of other provisions in place that work even better than an outstation worker. So it's one of those areas where feds are willing to turn a blind eye. Turning to outreach, one of our initial findings we were discouraged with was that we found only 13 Medicaid programs that actually dedicated funding to outreach explicitly in their state budgets. The more we dug and scratched, though, on that issue, we found that that this wasn't a very good indicator, in fact, because there could have been full-time equivalent staff doing outreach that showed up elsewhere in the Medicaid budgets. There could have been other kinds of activities being funded out of other budget categories. So this didn't necessarily tell us what we were interested in learning. So we asked a lot of questions again in the survey about what kinds of outreach states were doing to pregnant women. And you can see the broad range of strategies going on here. Relatively few states invested in media, probably because of the cost. But those that did invested in both television and radio sorts of public service announcements. Twice as many states instead targeted their resources to the community level, grants to communities to conduct more grassroots outreach, to provide application assistance. A lot of the community-based work was actually coordinated with managed care organizations. A fairly good number of states identified strategies that really targeted subsets of the perinatal population. Most oftenly identified were adolescents and immigrant mothers. Quite a number of states, almost 20, provide incentives as part of their Medicaid outreach initiatives, gift cards, baby showers, car seats. And those sorts of efforts are often, again, coordinated with managed care organizations that the women are enrolled in. About half the states invest in print materials and do so in multiple languages. We heard a lot about the states trying to be good about developing culturally appropriate materials in alternative languages, Spanish, Russian, Chinese, Korean. We even heard of Creole down in Louisiana and Florida and Navajo in New Mexico and Arizona. And 36 states operated toll-free hotlines for pregnant women. So again, we see quite a range of initiatives. I would point out, though, that most of these state totals in this case are actually lower than they were in the late 80s and early 90s. So we think overall there's been some slippage in terms of investments and outreach. And then turning to enhanced prenatal care, the news is mostly good. Again, we see very high numbers of states for the most part, more than half and less than two-thirds, investing in services like targeted case management, perinatal risk assessment, nutritional and psychosocial counseling, health education, home visiting, smoking cessation, and the like. Here we think the findings are actually a bit, I don't know if I'd say inaccurate or misrepresented, because of the advent of managed care. I think that states, used to be in a fee-for-service world that states would identify every covered benefit in a state plan. Now, through contracting with managed care organizations, a lot of that detail disappears unless the state is particularly good about writing its managed care contracts. So we think that a lot of this kind of work may be going on in managed care settings that we don't know about necessarily. Of course, one could view the glass as half empty, though, and worry a lot about whether managed care organizations are doing the right thing. Okay, as I said, we did telephone follow-up interviews with 10 states that appeared to be doing more than the average. Those states were Connecticut, New York, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Louisiana, Georgia, Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico. I don't have time to go into those results here today, but what I'll do instead is hop over to our case study component where we, after talking to the 10 states, we chose three that were doing, had particularly interesting stories to tell. The three states that we visited here, as you can see, are Louisiana, New York, and New Mexico. We actually haven't done the New Mexico visit yet. What we did in selecting these states was we tried to identify states that had really woven together an interesting array of outreach and enrollment strategies. We also tried to pick states that were quite different from one another in terms of their history and the target of their investment. And we wanted to, you know, of course, highlight a range of things so that states and March of Dimes chapters could learn from a variety and apply those lessons elsewhere. Our methodology was that our site visits are about 3 days in length. We started each visit with a visit to the state capital where we interviewed a range of state officials, and then we went out to local areas to kind of see outreach and enrollment strategies in action. I will hit just a couple of highlights from these case studies, and particularly focusing in on Louisiana first and then New York. The case study in Louisiana is actually quite interesting in that they were one of the laggards back in the 80s and the early 90s. They took almost no advantage of the various OBRA initiatives that I spoke of a few minutes ago. They were barely complying with federal minimums with eligibility at 133% of poverty. Not much investment in outreach, very little simplification. Louisiana always ranking toward the bottom back in the day on MCH outcome indicators. The turning point for Louisiana really was with the creation of its CHIP program, which they call Law CHIP. Because of the leadership of, you learn a lot about how an individual or a couple of individuals can really make a difference in a state. And because of the leadership of a woman named Ruth Kennedy, there was a huge culture change in Louisiana's Medicaid program. They really tried to change the culture from that of a welfare organization to a service organization. They tried to set up rules that would invite enrollees as opposed to trying to keep them out. They invested in some significant but simple grassroots outreach. They vastly simplified the eligibility process for kids, and they enjoyed very strong enrollment trends. I would say that virtually every CHIP evaluation conference you might have gone to in the last 10 years, Ruth would be there talking about all the good things that Louisiana did. Well, the good news there was that they took all those good lessons from La CHIP and created a new initiative called La Moms, really built on the template of their CHIP work. Le Mans was marketed in very much the same way. The materials looked a lot like Le Chip materials, so that the brand recognition was there. The state outreach strategy was almost entirely focused on the objective of enrollment, getting pregnant women in. Louisiana is a state-administered program, so that the state was able to set policy at the state level, roll it out through 9 regional district offices, roll it out subsequently to 46 parish offices. They call them parishes down there, not counties. And then within the parishes, over 400 certified enrollment centers. Because it was state administered, they were able to implement it very consistently across the state. The partners in the effort were very much grassroots. They included community-based organizations, faith-based organizations, and schools. The simplification strategies that they invested in were doing away with the requirement of a medical verification of pregnancy as a term of eligibility. It costs money to go to the doctor and get a medical verification, and so that itself was creating a barrier, so they did away with that. They also gave eligibility workers the flexibility to determine reasonable certainty of income verification. And in other words, if someone's income was not within 25 percentage points of the upper limit of 200% of poverty, they just said, don't worry about it. You don't need to produce income stubs to prove that you're not making much money. Presumptive eligibility really wasn't working in Louisiana. It's often an option that sounds a little bit better on paper than in reality. Docs were actually feeling very exposed because a woman would get presumptive eligibility and then maybe not follow through on the full application, and then the doctor had felt committed to delivering care throughout the pregnancy. So instead, the state developed a very sophisticated application processing system that used data systems, state data systems and data matches to determine income eligibility and expedite the whole process. The effects of all those efforts were that Louisiana now processes applications for pregnant women in less than 5 days on average, and in less than 3 days in some of the most populated parishes in the state. Medicaid now covers over two-thirds of all births in the state. And very encouragingly, the state now climbed up the ranks to where it is now sixth best in terms of rates of adequate prenatal care. Here's a little graphic that shows you just how dramatic the improvement was in terms of Louisiana's ability to expedite processing of eligibility applications for pregnant women, reducing it from about a 20-day average in 2004 to less than 5 days, just a matter of a year later, and being able to maintain that. So that's one case study. I have time to talk about another one. New York couldn't provide a more polar opposite example, I think, in terms of where they've been and where they've come. They were actually one of the pioneers back in the 80s of setting the bar high in terms of infant mortality reduction. They took full advantage of all the various omnibus budget reconciliation acts. They increased eligibility to 200% of poverty. They adopted presumptive eligibility and a whole host of simplification strategies. They were also an innovator in terms of content of care. They created a program you may have heard of called PCAP, the Prenatal Care Assistance Program, which created standards for the content and breadth of prenatal services. Under Medicaid, it required such services as risk assessment, plan of care development, nutritional and psychosocial counseling, health education, and care coordination for every pregnant woman enrolled in Medicaid. It set up a system for certifying providers as being PCAP, meeting PCAP standards, which qualified them for enhanced reimbursement. PCAP providers were also required to have presumptive eligibility capacity, so the enrollment piece was linked with the content of care. So New York was really, again, out on the cutting edge. During our case study, what we learned is that over time, the state approached outreach with a very broad brush. They consider outreach to not only involve access to coverage, but also access to higher quality care. We learned about the range of strategies that the state has taken on. Some of them are more traditional social marketing, toll-free hotlines and paid media, but also lots of less traditional efforts like the creation of perinatal networks, which fund coalitions of providers and community-based organizations in various regions of the state to try to coordinate care perinatal forums, which point monies towards hospitals to help with their regionalization efforts. We learned about a multitude of home visiting programs across the state that strategically target high-risk women or high-risk communities. Some use community health workers, community health worker models. Others use the David Olds nurse family partnership model. Some target women with HIV. Others target communities with zip codes with poor indicators. A whole host of things going on in the state. What was also neat to study in New York was the strength of their efforts to integrate outreach and enrollment efforts with managed care organizations. A very well-established managed care system in Medicaid in New York. What they did, in short, was set up contracts with managed care plans, whereas all health plans must comply with PCAP standards of care. All health plans must have presumptive eligibility capacity. Most health plans actually contract with the pre-existing PCAP providers to meet those standards. And state officials are described to us lots of recent efforts to monitor the quality of care delivered in health plans using several key perinatal indicators. And they're actually now keying payment rates to performance on those measures. So very, very cutting-edge stuff. Importantly, New York officials were the first ones to tell us that their system was far from perfect. That in some ways there are almost too many things going on for them to keep track of, too many initiatives layered upon one another to know which was having which particular effect. And so they were actually in the process of doing some strategic planning to try to look at ways to integrate, for example, all of their various home visiting programs. Here again are a little bit of data to illustrate this for you. This shows you the percentage of women receiving care and their first prenatal care within the first trimester, and you can watch and see how Medicaid rates have improved over the years, especially in relation to women in commercial insurance, where it's been pretty stable. And so we see a narrowing of the gap there. So let me just stop there and say that overall from this study, again, we were trying to kind of take stock of things today and compare them to where they were back in the heyday of outreach and enrollment for pregnant women. I think the good news is that states continue to place a pretty high priority on this population. As always, there's tremendous variation from state to state. I think that if we looked at the three particular areas that we explored, enrollment simplification to some extent has advanced since the 1990s, especially in the area of the internet and online applications and whatnot. Outreach, though, has been scaled back. Most states' investments, they find that one of the first areas to cut whenever hard times come along. Enhanced prenatal care benefits, pretty good. Some scaling back, but overall not bad at all. So I think it's a classic, depending on your mood of the day, the glass could be half full or half empty. I think things have not deteriorated significantly. At the same time, there's considerable room for improvement. So thanks very much for your time. I hope it was helpful.
Thank you. I'm going to ask if we can hold our questions for both of our presenters till the very end. Our second and final presenter of this session will be Dr. Christina Chambers. She's from the Department of Pediatrics and Family and Preventive Medicine at the University of California, San Diego. So she didn't have a long trip here. She will be talking about teratogen information specialists, working with clinicians to promote healthy mothers and babies.